From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. So, is there a deal or not? That is the question in Washington today after some leading Republicans balked at President Biden's demand that a new compromise bill on infrastructure be tied to a separate spending bill, one that includes other Democratic priorities like child care and climate change.
And the president is now threatening to veto the infrastructure bill if it's divorced from a bill Democrats are calling family infrastructure.
I expect that in the coming months this summer, before the fiscal year is over, that we will have voted on this bill, as well the infrastructure bill, as well as voted on the budget resolution. And that's when they'll. But if only one comes to me, I'm not. If this is the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it. It's in tandem.
Let's bring out our political roundtable now. Alex Thompson is White House reporter for Politico, and Chad Pergram is a congressional correspondent for Fox News. Hi, Chad, and hi, Alex. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get down to the politics, can you briefly explain for us, Chad, some of the major things in the infrastructure bill?
Well, the thing that we're waiting for is actual bill text. We don't have that yet. We're probably going to get that in July. But this is good old-fashioned infrastructure. We've heard a lot of, crowing about that, that there's some things that Democrats want that aren't infrastructure in terms of bridges and roads and steel and mortar and stuff like that. So what they're looking at here are actual highway projects. They are looking at actual bridges. At some point, there's probably going to be a list. There's a lot here in terms of how they're going to pay for this, dealing with getting the IRS to be more involved, broadband auctions with 5G and things like that. But we don't have bill text. And until you have bill text, you don't really know what something is. This is a pretty vague agreement. And politically, it is a very brittle agreement.
Let's bring up this issue that Republicans are saying. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said that Democrats tying bills together is like pulling the rug out from under Republican negotiators. Here he is yesterday on the Senate floor.
Both the Democratic leader and the Speaker of the House made it clear they would hold the bipartisan agreement hostage, demanding trillions of dollars in wasteful spending and job-killing tax increases in return or even considering it.
Alex, Democrats don't need McConnell's vote as long as they have 10 other Republicans, but is this putting the deal in jeopardy?
Oh, it's 100% in jeopardy. I mean, this thing could fall apart over the weekend at this point after Joe Biden did a pretty public victory lap yesterday. The big problem isn't that he's doing both of these bills. Republicans knew that there was going to be another reconciliation bill with trillions of dollars of spending that Democrats were going to try to pursue, even as they did infrastructure. The problem is the veto threat that Biden issued that caught a lot of Republicans by surprise. And a lot of the Republicans that he had negotiated this bill with were caught completely off guard, did not realize that there was a veto threat involved, and believed they were all on the same page. Biden's words yesterday have completely put this deal in jeopardy. And as a result, Biden is in a tough position because he's already done a victory lap on the deal. So if he does not, right now they're trying to say, well, it's not been any secret that he supports both bills. But I'm not sure how sustainable it is, because you could see a bunch of Republicans jumping ship in the next few days unless Biden reverses himself. But if he does, if Biden reverses himself, he's going to get a lot of blowback from the left. So he's in a really tough position, and this deal is very brittle right now.
Well, Democrats are still projecting confidence. Here's Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg speaking to CNBC this morning.
Well, we're doing them at the same time. And I think the fundamental question is not which month, which date, which part of which bill passes. The fundamental question is, are we going to deliver for the American people? And yes, the American people expect and demand that we deliver things like child care, other things that aren't in this compromise, like improving veterans' hospitals. Of course, we're going to continue working on that. That's how two tracks strategy works. We'll do one part on the one track and the other part on the bipartisan track.
So, Chad, we heard Alex talk to us about the Republican point of view, but what about the Democratic point of view here? Because there's no guarantee that moderate Democrats will all be on board with the idea of passing the second reconciliation bill without Republicans.
And that's where I might quibble a little bit with what Secretary Buttigieg said, because it was pretty clear. He said it doesn't matter the timing. Well, it does matter the timing. This is where you had Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, saying we're going to do these bills together. It's where you had Nancy Pelosi saying, I have to have those bills through first before I even touch them in the House of Representatives. And let's be clear, this creation of this separate $5 to $6 trillion reconciliation bill, as it's being called, and we call it reconciliation because that means they can sidestep filibusters, that is an appeal to the left, because they have to get those members, those liberal members, on board here. And that's why Republicans turn around and ask why they should play along if Democrats are still going to push their big bill. And then, you know, there's going to be, you know, pushes for tax hikes and things like that. And there, and members of the Republican Party probably wonder if Democrats are hoodwinking them. I mean, did they lay a trap here? Because Democrats could then blame the GOP for pushing back from the table and saying, hey, you know, we're not in for that. And Democrats will say, look, you guys came to the table. You're the ones not being bipartisan. Maybe if there is some political gamesmanship going on here, maybe it's because that was the plan all along, that the Democrats were going to do their own partisan bill.
Alex, what is the window of opportunity here, not only for this big infrastructure bill, but for all of the other ambitious projects that the Biden administration and Democrats are trying to get through? Is the window closing?
Yeah, every day that goes by, the window is closing. I mean, we're talking about the end of September, end of October here. And you will notice that the interesting thing about what Secretary Buttigieg said was that he did not reiterate Joe Biden's veto threat. And that is a notable, and you're seeing right now as Jen Psaki takes the podium right before I got on this call, Jen Psaki is also not reiterating the veto threat that Joe Biden issued. So it's becoming clear they're trying not to, you know, have Joe Biden completely walked back his veto threat while also not reiterating it. They are trying to, you know, very aggressively trying to keep this deal together. But to your point, I mean, we're talking, you know, end of September, end of October, probably at the latest, you know, for this window. And then after that, you're into campaign season and you're not going to get any, you know, huge, big $1 trillion packages. It just becomes harder and harder.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring up something else at the time that we have with you two. Yesterday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced a selection committee would investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol. That comes 1 month after Senate Republicans blocked this attempt to form an independent bipartisan commission. Here's Pelosi.
We see this as complementary, not instead of, and hopeful that there could be a commission at some point.
Chad, can we get any answers with this selection committee without politics getting in the way?
Well, this select committee, you know, is kind of modeled on what Republicans did to the Democrats, notably Hillary Clinton. It's very similar to a Benghazi committee. Now, there's a couple of things that Pelosi is doing here. Number one, she's trying to gin up support in the Senate, maybe to pluck off two, three other Republican senators. Maybe they can get over a filibuster and actually get a commission like they had the 9/11 commission. But this is a separate track. And basically, Pelosi, you know, she was pretty noncommittal yesterday as to the time of this select committee, number one. Number two, she was asked directly whether or not they should call Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader. Remember, he had this screaming match with former President Trump, and that could be very revealing and pretty damning, frankly. And so when you have something like this that could bleed into 2022, naturally, it's going to be political. The question I would have is, will Republicans play ball? Democrats, when Republicans were in the majority and created the Benghazi committee, they were only tacitly involved in that because they didn't view it as having much credibility. And we wonder if Republicans might, you know, approach that in the same fashion as Democrats did with the Benghazi committee as it pertains to the 1-6 select committee.
And just real quick, Chad, to follow up on what you just said, do you think that House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy could be subpoenaed to testify?
That's very possible. Again, Pelosi was asked that question straight up. You know, one of the key issues in the impeachment trial, the second impeachment trial with President Trump, was this conversation, information that came out from Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler, a Republican from Washington State. And that held up the impeachment trial for a little bit to get some of her information into the record. We actually thought they were going to call witnesses and drag this out for 2 or 3 weeks. So that is a critical point, what McCarthy knew, what that conversation was like. And of course, the politics of that is that Kevin McCarthy's view of President Trump seems to have changed a lot from that screaming match on the 6th of January.
Alex, I'm sorry, Tanya, do you want to jump in?
No, please do.
I just wanted to know if you had an idea of what kind of Republicans you think that McCarthy might want to put on this committee if it happens.
I mean, McCarthy will obviously want to put people that, are going to, I think the biggest priority you're hearing from Republicans, if there is such a committee, is they want this done quickly. They don't want this to drag into election season next year. That was, Mitch McConnell and his allies put it pretty bluntly as part of their rationale for opposing the Senate version. I think, the whole point is the January 6th commission, no matter what, it's not going to be good for Republicans. And they know that. The question is it bad for Republicans in the summer and fall of 2022, or is it bad in the winter of 2021?
Alex Thompson from Politico and Chad Pergram is a congressional correspondent for Fox News. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All this week, we've been exploring and reflecting on the ways in which the war on drugs has affected our country. It has been 50 years since President Nixon launched his aggressive strategy to crack down on drug use and addiction, sending a disproportionate number of people of color to prison. Two communities in particular, Huntington, West Virginia, and Brownsville, New York, have found themselves on the front lines of this war. And NPR's addiction correspondent Brian Mann went to both places to hear how people there are dealing with the impact. Brian, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
So you met two very different people in these very different places, and both have felt the impact of the war on drugs. Tell us about who they are and what you learned about the way addiction has changed their lives.
Yeah, these were two people who were generous enough to kind of take me inside their communities, which, as you mentioned, were hit really hard. Aaron Hinton is a community organizer in Brownsville, this predominantly black community in New York City. And Aaron lost his own mother to a drug overdose in 2017.
You never really get over it, so it is kind of difficult to deal with, but you just find a way to deal with it and you just keep going.
And this has happened so often in his community. And the other person who I got to know as part of this reporting is Courtney Hessler. She's a journalist with a local newspaper in West Virginia. Her mother has struggled with opioid addiction. It ravaged her family. Courtney herself wound up in foster care as a child.
I was just mad all the time and just constantly just going, living my life just from a place of hate. And there was a point where I said, okay, there's something wrong with me. I really need to get help.
And so really, Peter, what these two, again, were generous enough to do is take me inside their own lives, the way their families have been affected by drug policy and by addiction, and also to kind of walk me through the wider impact in their towns and in their neighborhoods.
So, right, those are individuals. What about Brownsville and Huntington? What were some of the similarities and differences that you found when you compared what these drug war policies have done?
Yeah. Well, what's really interesting, Peter, is that we spent hundreds of billions of dollars arming whole new armies of police, federal agents, creating whole new bureaucracies that were designed to protect people from addiction, from illicit drugs. And these two communities found that those efforts just simply didn't work. And in fact, they wound up in many cases doing more harm than good in, as you note, in very different ways. Huntington, West Virginia is sort of ground zero of the opioid epidemic. The Drug Enforcement Administration documents show they allowed tens of millions of prescription painkillers to flow into this community. And that has devastated people there. Brownsville, meanwhile, this much more black African-American community, the main impact there has been these astonishingly high rates of incarceration. Everyone you talk to there has been in prison, has a family member who's been in prison. It's a normal part of life there, largely because of these policy decisions around addiction.
So I hear you saying that there may be some acknowledgement from people who live in these places that the war on drug policies didn't work, right? But I guess the question is, has anything been done since to rectify it?
I think there have been significant policy changes. Everybody I speak to says, look, the war on drugs is still ongoing. It's still happening. The Biden administration has asked for more money for drug interdiction and for drug fighting than ever before in this next year's budget. But that said, you know, there is a shift in these communities to health care. There is a shift to treatment. There is much more money and investment for those kinds of things. The federal government has sharply curtailed the flow of those prescription drugs to pharmacies in places like Huntington. That's a major difference. And then, you know, one other thing, Peter, that has really happened that is dramatic is that many of the harshest drug era laws have been repealed. That means far fewer people going to prison from places like Brownsville, and people in those communities describe that as a huge relief.
So change is coming or has been happening, but I think it's fair to say that communities that have been impacted by this war on drugs are often written off as lost causes and that they don't have a chance or that they can't bounce back. You know, when you spoke with Courtney and Aaron, what did they tell you about that, how they're feeling about the future?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because when you go to these communities that are often described in popular literature or in movies, TV series as just sort of dead places, places that are, you know, junkies on the street, people leaning in street corners, you know, often the popular culture does write them off. And people in these places say they felt abandoned. But these are pretty cool communities. I mean, you walk around in Brownsville and there's, you know, shops open and people selling stuff and people taking their kids to school. There are beautiful little parks and organic gardens. And Huntington is this beautiful small southern city along the shore, the bank of the Ohio River. And people in these towns, Courtney and Aaron for sure, but lots of other people I spoke to, they say, no, you know, we have a future. There is a way for us to heal. Nobody I spoke to thinks that that's going to happen fast. There is deep harm, deep scars. There remains very high levels of poverty. You know, some of the original sort of things that led to this opening for drug addiction, high unemployment, poverty, those things still remain. And so, you know, there are many hurdles here, but these are communities that say, we demand help. We really believe that we can have a future.
Well, this is part of a series we have been covering all week on NPR. NPR's addiction correspondent, Brian Mann, thank you very much for your reporting. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Peter.
Well, the temperature is forecast to rise to 112 degrees on Sunday in Eugene, Oregon, and that is where the U.S. track and field Olympic trials are set to wrap up this weekend. Organizers are moving some events to the early morning as a result of the potentially record-breaking heat wave. Dr. Sean Robinson specializes in sports medicine at the Oregon Health and Science University School of Medicine in Portland. Dr. Robinson, welcome. What do you think is competing in weather this hot? Is it going to be safe?
Yeah, we don't use just temperature by itself when we think about safety and canceling races or postponing races. We use something called a wet bulb globe temperature. And it takes into a few things into account: humidity, wind speed, sun angle, and cloud cover. And it gives us a better idea of what the conditions are going to be like and how we can then direct the event. And so it's going to be tough. They've done a good job by moving the events, but we see, you know, performance detriments with temperatures as low as in the 70s for, you know, a 5K, for instance, or even, you know, in the 60s for the marathon distance. So luckily nobody's running a marathon this weekend, but it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough even with the moving. But I do think it's safe if they can move the events.
Right. And you were saying good idea to move these events from the hottest part of the afternoon to much earlier in the morning. But do you think that's enough? Are there other things that can or should be done?
Yeah, these athletes should be thinking about how can they cool themselves down. And there's been some studies about trying to, you know, target different areas on the body. So we think about the core temperature and trying to cool your core. So there are some folks that will use ice vests. And then there's some data out of Stanford and Dr. Heller's lab that looks at cooling the body through the palms of your hands, the soles of your feet, and your face. And there's some different skin and vessels in these areas that make it much more efficient, they think, to target these areas.
Are you better able as an athlete to condition yourself to the heat and perform in the heat if you train in warm weather?
Correct. So that's been known for some of the really long distance athletes, like the ultra athletes, you know, the Western States 100s happening this weekend down in California, which will also be very hot. And these athletes who will be exposed to it for much longer will be doing sessions in the sauna. People are running in the sauna if they can figure out a way to do that. Or they'll go out on runs on really hot days layered up to try to get their body conditioned to those.
Okay, well, I want to ask you about that because I live in Arizona and I often see people running in the middle of the day in the summer when it's well over 100 degrees, sometimes 110 degrees. And I always wonder if it's safe for people to be doing that. So if you're not an Olympic hopeful and you're not necessarily the most fit person in the world, what do you think? Is there a threshold where you should just say, you know what, it's too hot, I'm going to stay inside?
Definitely, yeah. It's just not worth the risk of heat illness. You know, for a 5K race, we're looking at the increased risk happens at about 84 degrees on a wet bulb globe temperature. So it doesn't take much. The drier environments, you can get away with the ambient temperature being a little bit hotter, but you go down to, you know, Kona for the Ironman that's held down there, or situations like Florida where you can get yourself into really big trouble because evaporation mechanisms stop working in humid environments and works a little bit better in your nice dry Arizona environments. But prevention is key. Just avoid the hot weather as much as possible.
Dr. Sean Robinson, a sports medicine expert at Oregon Health and Science University's School of Medicine. Dr. Robinson, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
I'm Gregory Warner, host of NPR's Rough Translation. The military helped launch Silicon Valley, but now they're kind of on the outs.
You're surprised that you look at me and say, no, that's not possible. Yes, it is.
And so it just dawned, this is just not going anywhere.
Stories of communication and miscommunication each week on Homefront from Rough Translation.
When civil war broke out in Syria 10 years ago, the U.S. and other Western and Arab countries tried to replace or isolate the Syrian regime. But President Bashar al-Assad is still in power. In this Encore report, NPR's Ruth Sherlock says many countries are now turning toward the regime again.
In the last few years, there's been a quiet march back to Damascus from countries that had cut relations with Assad. Jordan and Kuwait have reopened embassies there. Oman has appointed a new Syrian ambassador. Saudi Arabia, who spent millions arming the rebels in the war, has sent its intelligence chief to meet with the regime. In one prominent example, the United Arab Emirates, once an opponent to the Syrian regime, now supports it. In this video recording of a speech in late 2019, Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad publicly thanks the UAE for, quote, standing by Syria in the war against terrorism. Analysts say the UAE's support seems to include releasing money frozen in Emirati banks, sending planes filled with aid and cash to Damascus, and even offering to fund a Syrian military operation against Turkish-backed rebels in northern Syria. The UAE opposes Turkish influence in the region. And the United States is reevaluating its Syria policy too. The Trump administration pressured countries not to normalize with Syria. James Jeffrey, who was the special representative for Syria engagement under Trump, says the U.S. now is staying quiet.
What we are not doing now is discouraging the Emiratis and others from doing these openings to Assad.
He says there's a split in the Biden administration between those wanting to continue to isolate the Syrian government for its widely documented war crimes and those who want to move on. Without a clear U.S. policy on Syria, Jeffrey says, many countries are figuring out their own approach.
It's one of the excuses that the administration is using, or at least some in the administration use. Well, the Arabs have all given up. No, to some degree, they've given up because nobody in Washington is pressuring them to keep Assad out of the Arab League, keep the diplomatic and economic pressure on him.
In a written statement, the State Department told NPR that the US urges states in the Middle East to, quote, consider carefully the atrocities visited by the Assad regime on the Syrian people over the last decade. Strict US sanctions still prevent countries from engaging in any meaningful dealings with the regime. Contributing to Syria's reconstruction, for example, remains off the table. But Nicholas Harris, a senior analyst at the New Lines Institute in Washington, D.C., says one question is whether the administration will selectively wind down some sanctions as part of a grand bargain with the regime's ally, Russia, to shape Syria's future.
A lot of the policy is made in these quiet gestures. And this is sort of the fundamental brick and mortar of statecraft.
This month, the U.S. Treasury lifted sanctions on two businesses belonging to a top Syrian regime official. It's unclear why. For the Syrian opposition, all this is a bitter pill to swallow. Syrian author and pro-opposition commentator Ammar Abdelhamid says allowing the Syrian regime to come in from the cold sets a dangerous precedent.
And the least you can do is keep these regimes isolated and delegitimized, because once you accept them as okay, you're basically saying genocide is okay. or mass murder, crimes against humanity on a mass scale, systematic torture in prison, mass rape. All of these crimes, basically, are acceptable.
He says this sends a signal to other dictators in the world that human rights no longer matter. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Beirut.
U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced today that the Department of Justice is suing the state of Georgia over that state's controversial new restrictive voting law. Stephen Fowler of Georgia Public Broadcasting is here to join tell us more. And Stephen, what exactly is the argument that the Justice Department is making here?
Well, the Justice Department is saying that the 98-page voting law that was signed earlier this year contains several provisions that are intentionally designed to make it harder for Black Georgians to vote. That includes a ban on government entities mailing out absentee ballot applications, limitations on Dropbox uses, and a narrower window to request an absentee ballot. And they say all of this taken together is in retaliation for record turnout, record Black turnout in the 2020 election.
Does the challenge affect the law right now as it is?
Well, there are currently now 8 lawsuits pending challenging Georgia's different election law. Virtually every part of it is being challenged, and so it will take some time for those things to be sorted out. So the law is still in full effect as we speak.
All right. Well, this is the first significant move by the Biden administration against a number of new restrictive voting laws that have been passed by Republican-led state legislatures all over the country. Do you think this could be the beginning of something larger?
Absolutely. What we saw from the Attorney General today was a note that the Justice Department was going to use every available tool in their arsenal and every aspect of voting law to examine these changes that Republicans put forth after the 2020 election. And they say that Georgia is the first of potentially many that they're going to look at to see if these laws hold up to the scrutiny of the intended results or if they were actually disenfranchising people.
Stephen Fowler is a reporter with Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Someone recently said Mary J. Blige's voice articulates with laser precision the pain of a generation. That's especially true of her 1994 album, My Life. And out today is a new Amazon documentary that explores this album, that lays bare some of Blige's biggest life struggles. We wondered, what's it like to write the music telling the story of an album that means so much to so many people? Mervyn Warren has the answer. He's composed the score for this documentary titled Mary J. Blige's My Life. He's also a 5-time Grammy Award winner and 10-time Grammy nominee. And Mervyn Warren joins us now via Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Your trajectory, Mervyn, it's a fascinating story, which we will get to. But part of your story is your work on a number of well-known film scores with some big stars. What was the process for capturing the essence of this documentary while also maintaining that thing sonically that we love so much about Mary J. Blige's music?
Well, you know, it was the goal of the director, Vanessa Roth, and myself to, you know, underscore, to support the stories that were being told about Mary and by Mary herself, you know, recounting her life. But we wanted to support that musically in a way that complemented her own music, but also contrasted from her own music, so that the many songs that are featured in the film would stand out. We didn't want the score to sound like Mary's songs.
Well, Quincy Jones recommended you write the score for this film. You and Mary didn't know each other before this. And this documentary, she gets into some pretty dark places. Her childhood growing up in the projects, abusive relationships, depression. And she does this with the beat of your music. Here's a sample of your score. You know, Mervyn, I understand what you're saying when you talk about supporting her while also being distinct from her own music. She is very much a part of what we're hearing in this score.
Well, in a way she is. Vanessa had the idea of using a solo voice. She specifically asked for that element. She wanted that voice to at times represent loneliness or contemplation. It also represents childhood in a couple of scenes. And so that was something that she specifically asked for. And I'm always happy when a director has, you know, something specific like that. It gives me a launching point.
In addition to Mary, you've worked with, among others, Dolly Parton, Barbara Streisand, Faith Hill. You also produced and arranged most of the music for the late Whitney Houston's film, The Preacher's Wife. And I'm bringing this up because this is one of my favorites. Here's a classic, I Believe in You and Me. Mervyn, one thing that struck me looking at your accomplishments is that you've helped create some of the most powerful music with some of the most powerful women. Is that a coincidence or intentional?
It's a coincidence. That's a great question. I've never been asked that before. It's purely coincidence, but I certainly love working with women, and I certainly love, you know, working with men as well. But you're right. I have worked with a lot of female vocalists, and Whitney was certainly one of my favorites, just having created either arrangements or even writing an original song for her and creating those musical beds. And then when she stepped up to that mic and began to sing, I became a fan instead of a producer. Well, I was already a fan, but I mean, I put on my fan hat, and it's just like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Your background, you first learned to play the piano at age 5. You grew up in a religious household. You didn't hear much pop or R&B music growing up. How did your musical ear evolve?
That's very true. You did your homework. I actually started out with very distinct jazz leanings, and my parents didn't listen to a lot of jazz in the home other than the Swingle Singers. I'm dating myself now for people who know who the Swingle Singers are. I grew up on the Swingle Singers, Edwin Hawkins, and Andre Crouch. Oh, and Ferrante and Teicher. And so I had this sort of interesting mix of things, and I had distinctive jazz leanings, which of course, you know, later led me to my work with Take Six. But I listened to a little bit of everything, and I was able to sneak and listen to other things, and I sort of absorbed all sorts of musical styles that have informed and helped me, do the work that I do today.
You mentioned Take Six, and, you know, we're going through this whole interview with me pretending like I don't know you from that group. I mean, that is probably one of your most forward-facing accomplishments as a member of Take Six. You're mostly a composer and producer now. Where is your career leading you?
You know, I still straddle the fence between producing artists for listening and film, but I definitely have a thrust toward film and TV. I enjoy both of it. It's different parts of the brain. It's not exactly left and right brain, but it's, you know, different parts of the creative brain to write songs and produce artists versus the sort of mathematical, if you will, approach that's required for scoring film and TV. But I love it all, and I hope to continue doing it all.
Mervyn Warren is the Grammy-winning composer of the score for the new documentary, Mary J. Blige's My Life. It drops on Amazon Prime today. Mervyn Warren, thank you so much for this conversation.
And thank you.
Okay, and I just had to hear a little take six. So this is Spread Love, which Mervyn co-produced.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani meets with President Biden at the White House this afternoon to discuss the future of U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Taliban attacks on Afghan forces are accelerating, and U.S. intelligence agencies now say the government in Kabul could fall within 6 months of American troop withdrawal. President Biden has pledged to bring all American troops home by September 11th, but the Associated Press is reporting that the U.S. will keep around 650 troops in Afghanistan after that deadline. Michael Kugelman is deputy director at the Asia program at the Wilson Center, and he joins us now on Skype. Michael, welcome back.
Good to be here with you.
And first to this report about the United States keeping a few hundred troops in Afghanistan after that withdrawal deadline. What do you think? Is that something that President Ghani wanted?
Well, absolutely. I think that one of Ghani's big asks, so to speak, is that the U.S. slow down the pace of the withdrawal so that you have some remaining U.S. forces in Afghanistan until the very last day before that September deadline, just because there had been some talk in earlier weeks that the U.S. would try to have the final withdrawal done as early as July. Now, the fact that we're hearing that some troops could remain in Afghanistan beyond the deadline would be a huge relief for Ghani and for Afghanistan, given how ferocious the insurgency has become in Afghanistan. But I think that the one question, now that this news has come out of some U.S. troops remaining beyond that September deadline, is how does the Taliban react? You know, the Taliban has been insistent that all U.S. troops must be out of the country by the time of the final withdrawal. And you know, the U.S. and the Taliban signed an agreement last year that stipulated that every single U.S. troop be out of the country by May. Now it's supposed to be September, but the fact that the U.S. plans to keep some there brings up the question as to what would the Taliban do? Might it try to turn its guns on those remaining forces? That remains to be seen.
You think it might put those Americans at risk?
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the outcomes of the agreement that the U.S. signed with the Taliban in February 2020 is that U.S. forces would leave the country, and that in that interim period before the U.S. forces left, the Taliban would no longer target them. And this is why we have not had any U.S. Combat deaths in Afghanistan since that point. But if the Taliban hears that the U.S. is going to retain some forces in the country beyond the final withdrawal, then I think that one has to wonder how one has to fear how the Taliban might react. And indeed, I think that those remaining U.S. troops could find themselves in harm's way.
I want to ask you about the U.S. intelligence report that we saw this week saying that within 6 months of American troops leaving Afghanistan, the Taliban is likely to regain control of the country and topple the government. What's your impressions of that intelligence? Is there anything in there that's surprising to you, or does that make sense?
To me, it sounds a bit off. I think that certainly the Taliban will continue to make tremendous gains after U.S. forces leave. The fact that you'll no longer have U.S. air power in the country as an option for Afghan troops to call in to help them on the ground means that it'll be much easier for the Taliban to enter and unfortunately seize a number of cities. And of course, that's the road to seizure of the government on the whole. But the U.S. Has committed to providing continued financial assistance to the Afghan military, which is critical because I think that so long as the Afghan armed forces continue to be able to pay for equipment and to pay their foot soldiers, that should be able to keep things together. And certainly the fact that we now, it sounds like there will be some small numbers of U.S. troops remaining, that could help keep things at bay as well. And, you know, the Afghan security forces, as much as they're beleaguered and as much as they're struggling, I mean, this is a professional fighting force that is able to hold off the Taliban. And, you know, let's not forget that, as you know, we hear so much about these dozens of districts that the Taliban has seized in recent weeks, and they have, but we hear less about the fact that in some cases, Afghan forces have been able to retake some of these districts that have been seized by the Taliban. So I think that that estimate was, I think it was a bit unrealistic, but I certainly hope that it's not correct.
President Biden is saying this week as well that Afghans who worked with the U.S. military are going to be evacuated from that country, and it would protect them from being targeted by the Taliban when the U.S. troops withdraw. This could be thousands of people. Do you think it's the right move?
The U.S. owes it to all of those Afghans that worked directly with the U.S. in Afghanistan. And I think that there's naturally a lot of bureaucratic and administrative obstacles. And as I understand it, the COVID pandemic in Afghanistan has also made it difficult for the U.S. to work through this process. But, you know, you need to go out there and pull out all the stops and do whatever is necessary to ensure that these Afghans that have helped Americans are brought out of the country, preferably with their families as well, and put in a place where they'll be more safe. The Taliban has sent out statements assuring that these Afghans that have worked with the U.S. will be safe in Afghanistan as long as they don't do any more of that. But, you know, let's be very clear. You know, those that had worked with the U.S. are not going to trust those assurances from the Taliban, given the Taliban's track record.
Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director of the Asia Program at the Wilson Center. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.